From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Between 1861 and 1865, hundreds of thousands of Americans, North and South, volunteered to fight in the Civil War. More than 600,000 Americans never came home from that war. Charles Russell Lowell, Jr. was one who fell in battle. Lowell, maybe like John Kerry, was a high-born Massachusetts Yankee of modest means and great ambition. For him, as for many thousands of the flower of North and South in the Civil War, that ambition was ultimately turned toward death. Lowell helped Robert Gould Shaw form the famous 54th Regiment of black volunteers cut down at Fort Wagner. At 29, he met his own end in the Shenandoah Valley at the head of a huge cavalry charge in the Battle of Cedar Creek, a Union victory that helped re-elect Abraham Lincoln and thus steer the course of history. Today, in another time of war, a vivid new biography of Lowell unfolds the powerful culture of sacrifice, even martyrdom, that he and others came to embrace. Tonight on Point, an extraordinary life and death in the Civil War and the nature of sacrifice. You can join the conversation. Are there common themes in every story of war, or is the heart of each war different? And when does the readiness to fight become the knowing readiness to sacrifice and die? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Carol Bundy, great-great-great-niece of the man we investigate tonight and author of the new book, The Nature of Sacrifice, a biography of Charles Russell Lowell, Jr., 1835-64. Carol Bundy, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
Wow, what a great-great-great uncle you've got.
That's
here.
Absolutely right.
And a story that cuts right across time. On Memorial Day, everyone's thinking about sacrifice. But in this book, you point out just how explicit and how enormous the kind of almost cult of sacrifice and martyrdom became in this time, in this war, and in this man, Charles Russell Lowell Jr.'s particular set. Give us a sense, before we get to the details of his life at all, of how sacrifice, even martyrdom, came to play.
Well, he was, along with his friends, a child of the Transcendentalists. That is to say, all these young men's parents were idealists, were reformers, and inevitably that set the children on a course. They were all anti-slavery. Many of them were abolitionist. And within the Northern abolitionist movement, there was a great emphasis on martyrdom. It had begun in 1835 with some of the casualties in the early anti-slavery movement and continued on through, of course, the execution of John Brown, who, however much everybody might have agreed that his Harper's Ferry attack was an act of insanity, many Northerners, surprisingly, were able to separate him from the action and saw him as a prophet of what was to come, and his death as part of this martyrdom of purists who were visionaries of a future that was not yet arrived.
Mm. Charles Russell Lowell, Jr., I think to understand his beginnings in a way and their import, we have to have a sense of his end, and you write about it grippingly at the beginning of the book here. A funeral at Harvard, where he attended, where he was first in his class in 1854, as I
right.
recall.
Absolutely.
A funeral attended, I mean, talk about a display of a young man who ranked high in Boston society by Longfellow, by Emerson, by Oliver Wendell Holmes, Charles Eliot Norson, Louis Agassiz.
Yep.
And then all these great names of wealth and power that kind of linked the Boston, New England industry to the Southern cotton. You call them Boston's cotton aristocracy, the Appletons, Lawrences, John Amory Lowells. And then, of course, he of the great China trade and a mentor to your subject, John Murray Forbes. I mean, an incredible turnout of the flower of Boston aristocracy at this funeral. Why? What did this young man, 29, stand for?
Well, there had been many deaths before, and so the
seven of his 14 cousins, you
exactly,
point out, for
and
example,
almost all of his childhood friends. And this loss had, become just ponderously heavy for Boston. And it had reunited the old split, being those Bostonians who made their wealth from cotton and who stuck with cotton, as opposed to those who went with conscience.
And sticking with cotton meant essentially sticking with the slave system
exactly.
that cotton depended on.
Yes, exactly. And those who went with conscience, who said no, 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 often because they did not actually have a monetary stake in the matter, let's try and end slavery. And this had really split families. It had split friends. It had split Boston's elite.
Between Federalists, that would be the cotton aristocracy, and Republicans.
Right. The old Whig Party had actually collapsed, and it was in that vacuum that the Free Soilers and then eventually the Republicans emerged. And but with the death of so many young men, quite a few fighting really for the Union, for the preservation of the Union, and then some also fighting for abolition, all these young men dying, the Boston elite came together again, really in grief, because, of course, it was cousins and friends who were all dying. And then it was also just before Lincoln's reelection. And so this death...
This is 1864.
This is 1864. It's the last days of October. And these... the Lowell represents a level of military prowess that was really rare in Massachusetts. Massachusetts contributed enormously to the war, but it did not produce great generals.
And the victory that he was part of, the battle that he died in, October 19, 1864, the battle at Cedar Falls, critical to the reelection of Lincoln, whose reelection was no sure thing.
No sure thing at all. Tremendous anxiety, tremendous weariness in the North, great desire to bring this war to an end.
And a challenge from General McClellan, who was saying, as opposed, Lincoln was saying, we have to stick with this. McClellan was saying,
peace. Let's make peace.
Cut a deal with the South.
Cut a deal. Let's end this now. And there was, you can imagine the temptation to want to do that. It would have been a terrible war. It must be said that Governor Andrew, the governor of Massachusetts, mm-hmm. did use this funeral as a way of gathering support for the Union cause, for rallying those powerful figures in Boston who could deliver the vote for Lincoln.
From that corner of the country, Reverend George Putnam was there. In his eulogy, he said, "This mighty mother of us all, our country, steeps her soul in her children's most precious blood. She tears her brightest jewels from her own forehead and flings them in the dust." Describe for us, in brief, how Charles Russell Lowell Jr. had died just days before.
Well, at Cedar Creek, there had been a surprise attack by the Confederate Army.
This is Shenandoah Valley, about, 75 miles west of Washington, maybe 100 and some miles north of Appomattox.
That's about right. It's right outside the town of Middletown mm-hmm. in the Shenandoah Valley. And it's the end of the campaign. General Sheridan has had the cavalry burn great chunks of the valley so that the Confederate Army can no longer live in the valley. There's no forage left. So it really has to fight or leave the valley. And yet the Union Army is just so cocky with success. They think they hold all the cards, and they are therefore surprised by a pre-dawn attack. Their camps, infantry camps, overrun, and a whole-scale panic is in full progress. When Lowell, who is part of the cavalry...
And you mean very literally overrun by the horses of the Confederacy.
I mean literally overrun. The Confederates are, spearing guys in their tents and so on, and... Lowell is getting no orders. He's off on the left. He can hear the battles going on. He's receiving no orders. And he finally realizes that the reason why he's getting no orders is because there is panic. This is not deliberate. And he decides to take things into his own hands, and he takes his brigade and another brigade and marches them 3 miles across the line of battle, directly going between the Confederate Army and the fleeing Union Army, drawing fire onto his own men. And his goal is to get to the town of Middletown. He wants to occupy that town. Unfortunately, he doesn't get there in time. The Confederates have taken that town. And his men have to then keep the Confederates from leaving the town. Some of them are, you know, have ditched their horses and are hiding behind stone walls or behind trees, providing cover as he uses his cavalry to make charges on the town that will just sort of keep the Confederates on the defensive. And his at the point, at this point, there's really nothing else he can do. For several hours, he has to just continue to do this in order to buy time. His goal is to buy time. The reason why he needs to buy time is that the infantry has to be rallied. The men have to be reconnected with their weapons and their units and their officers.
He's 3 months shy of his 30th birthday. He's had 13 horses shot from underneath him in the Shenandoah Valley. But on this day, he won't be so lucky. We're going to come and hear the climax of that battle after a short break here. We're talking tonight with Carol Bundy, author of the new biography, The Nature of Sacrifice. It's a biography of Charles Russell Lowell, Jr. You can join the conversation tonight. Are there common themes in every story of war life and war death, or is the heart of each war different? And can one soldier's motivations from the Civil War still speak to us today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a life and death in the American Civil War, the story of Charles Russell Lowell, Jr., who fought and died in the Shenandoah Valley in 1864. My guest tonight, Carol Bundy. She is the great-great-great-niece of Charles Russell Lowell, Jr., and author of the really quite terrific new biography, The Nature of Sacrifice. You can join the conversation tonight. When in war does the readiness to fight become a real, knowing readiness to sacrifice and die? And what are you prepared to sacrifice for today? Does Iraq meet your threshold or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So here we are, Carol Bundy, in the Shenandoah Valley that Charles Russell Lowell has helped put to the torch in great degree,
finding
his own dark side in war. We'll talk about that. Just a couple of weeks before Abraham Lincoln faces an uncertain re-election challenge, on which the whole progress or course of the war from there goes. Lowell has been in war 3.5 years, and no bullet has touched him. The first bullet hits him at Cedar Creek.
That's right. He's coming back from one of these charges on the village of Middletown, and a spent ball, which is to say a ball ricocheting
off a stone wall,
sweeps up through the kind of loose air of the arm of his jacket and hits him in the chest. It hits him hard enough that he is thrown back off his horse. He loses his voice. He's coughing up blood, and he's most likely fractured some ribs, maybe done some damage to his lung. And he is urged to leave the field, which he refuses to do.
Because?
Because he thinks that he has been mortally wounded. And He doesn't want to go into a hospital. I think that's one reason. The other reason is that he's been holding his men to their job, and there's panic. It's hard to describe what panic is like on this kind of a scale, but the
sort of
men,
a mayhem. I mean, here we have 52,000-53,000 men in this battle.
There's a lot of men, and a lot of them are scared, and they're running scared. And the other ones that are fighting because they're really being kept at the task. And if their officers start leaving the front line, it could break their resolve. This is the fear. And so all the...
If we can pause it just for a moment there. Here he is. He's taking his first bullet. He's refusing to leave the field. The conclusion is incredibly dramatic here on the field. But before we go there, two things. First of all, the Confederate forces on that day, there were about 32,000 Union forces, 21,000 Confederate troops. What did the Confederacy have on the line at the Battle of Cedar Creek?
It had two things on the line. First of all, it had the life of its cavalry on the line.
Because?
Well, it needed its cavalry. The Confederate cavalry had been stupendously successful. And, you know, men like Stuart, men like Fitzhugh Lee, and, you know, men like Thomas Rosser, great generals who had brought their men their to a peak of effectiveness that was daunting and really
daunting to the Union.
Daunting to
commanders.
The Union, absolutely. And without that cavalry, that there was a real weakness in the Confederate Army. They also really needed the Shenandoah Valley. They needed it for two reasons.
Even though it had been so torched. I mean, I read here you describing thousands and thousands of barns burned, 70 or 80 mills full of flour burned. I mean, countless livestock on the hoof, run off, killed, slaughtered by this sort of scorched earth policy of the Union.
Exactly. But this scorched earth policy was carried out along the highways. There were still hollows. There were still back ways.
Resources for the Confederacy.
Which had potential. And so it wasn't all lost. Mm-hmm. It was badly damaged for sure. But then the other reason was that the Shenandoah Valley had been the escape route. It had been the way up for the Lee to bring his army up, swing it up into Pennsylvania to Gettysburg, or to swing it round down through Maryland and attack Washington, as Early had done in July of 64. So this was an incredibly useful route, both up to threaten the North whenever they needed to do so, and also to retreat, safely retreat. And if they lost control of the valley, their hands would be tied, much less maneuver for them. And Grant at this time was pressing forward relentlessly in the most shockingly determined way. He refused to retreat.
Where was Grant now?
Grant had moved towards Petersburg. Now, he had started in the wilderness. He had the wilderness, Spotsylvania, Petersburg. He was going closer and closer to Richmond, never winning. Terrible cost, but he just didn't retreat.
And Petersburg, only 20, 30 miles from Richmond.
Exactly.
South of Richmond.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And the Confederates used that Shenandoah Valley. They kept sending Early up it to distract, to pull troops away from Richmond, anything to take the pressure off the men defending Richmond. So those were the two reasons why the valley was so important.
And now here we have Charles Russell Lowell. He's taken a spent bullet that's ricocheted off a stone wall. It's caused him some damage. He's already had tuberculosis and lung problems. I want to digress in another direction for a moment, because he will soon insist on being strapped into his saddle and lead an amazing cavalry charge. But surely somewhere in his mind that morning in Cedar Creek was Robert Gould Shaw, with whom he had formed the famous 54th, the Massachusetts 54th Regiment, the Black Volunteers, who had died in pitched battle that summer at Fort Wagner in South Carolina.
Yes, and Lowell had married Shaw's sister, Effie. And so when Shaw was killed, not only did Lowell lose one of his closest friends, but he, of course, had to try and comfort his wife on the death of her beloved brother.
And this, of course, is the scene, this death made famous in the movie Glory.
That's so right. Many
Americans will have seen it at this point. And Shaw famously dying on the parapets
of
the fort, out front of his troops, the kind of ultimate glorious death, and falls into the fort.
Yes.
Ultimately fails.
He led the 54th running straight to the parapet, straight to their death. And, you know, for the North, what that proved was that black men could die as gloriously, as valiantly in battle as any of the heroes of chivalric literature.
Mm-hmm.
And Lowell, writing to Effie at Shaw's death, says to her, "That is the time to die when one is happiest. Or rather, I mean, that is the time we wish those we love to die. Rob was very happy at the head of his regiment where he died. It is a very great comfort to know that his life had such a perfect ending. I see now that the best colonel of the best black regiment had to die. It was a sacrifice we owed, And how could it have been paid more gloriously?
Such a perfect ending and a sacrifice we owed. We've got to come back and look at that. But I want to take Charles Russell Lowell on here. He's wounded. He's strapped to his saddle and leads a charge of 3,000 horse into what?
Well, they're charging the village, which means they're charging an incredibly well-fortified town with sharpshooters on the rooftops, sharpshooters out of every window, all with the goal of picking off the officers. And
with the goal of picking off the Confederate officers.
I'm sorry. I mean that in the town, the
yes,
Confederates
the sharpshooters
have their
looking out on this, and they'll see the red sash of the officers.
Exactly.
And Lowell is where in this charge?
He is at the very head of the charge. He could have chosen to stand back in line, in the front line. But instead he brought his men and himself and his small group of men with him to the front, to the very front.
Why?
I think he wanted to signal that there would be no quailing, no turning back. Getting horses to charge, dealing with skittery horses and skittery men. You got two factors there. Mm-hmm. And he had a lot of different tricks that he used to get the men on the move fast.
Such as?
Well, he often used to come from the rear and gallop up. And if anybody knows horses, they know that any horse that's got a horse running up alongside it, it really helps.
It responds. It surges forward. Mm-hmm.
So even if the soldier's a bit iffy about things, that horse will start moving, and then it's pretty much too late.
It's not just at the Kentucky Derby where that effect sets
exactly.
in.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And with 3,000 horses, it's a kind of a chain effect right down the line.
Yes. And then once those horses start moving, the whole thing kind of takes off. Everybody kind of just gets overwhelmed with the exhilaration of galloping at breakneck speed.
When do the sabers come out?
The sabers come out as they charge. There is no firing. In the Union Army tended to fire before it charged, and then when it came to charge, it would use the saber. And interestingly, the Confederates didn't do this. The Confederates didn't really like the saber, which meant that if the Union got in there, if it made the charge and
into the ranks of these Confederate
got
infantry,
in among the Confederates, mm-hmm. it had free rein. It could really slash
away. Even though the Confederates would all be armed, they'd all have their
rifles.
But
they had to reload.
Yes.
So.
And a saber could work more quickly than a panicked
exactly.
soldier reloading.
Exactly.
So there he is at the head of 3,000. They're charging toward Middleton, and now comes his nearly.
So there he is. He's strapped in, obviously in a very weakened condition. He is shot almost immediately. They've picked him off, and he's shot between the shoulder blades, his spine severed. He falls from his horse, and the men create a litter, and he's carried behind the men as the charge moves forward and overruns the town and sets the Confederates on the run. Mm-hmm. And they begin to run in the way that they had run maybe 10 days before it at what became known as the Woodstock races.
And the tide of battle turns. Major General Philip Sheridan ultimately able to claim a victory there.
Absolutely.
Abraham Lincoln able to claim a victory that helps him surge to his electoral victory. And Charles Russell Lowell, of course, dead within a day of that second bullet.
Exactly.
At Cedar Creek, and within days back at the funeral in Boston. It's a long journey to come back to the beginning, but remind us who this man was, the kind of society that he was part of, born to.
Well, he had been born into the Lowell family, which was part of the Boston elite. This was a family that had built the Lowell Mills, that had played really one of the key roles in the industrialization of the Northeast, but also went back further. Men who had been there at the Constitutional Convention, men who had given over their great merchant fleets to the American Navy in the Revolution, and literary giants, James Russell Lowell, his uncle, a poet mm-hmm. of renown, his grandfather, Charles Russell Lowell, one of the few ministers who had held his pulpit for over 50 years, so deeply admired, deeply respectable.
but from a branch of the family that was no longer wealthy.
That's right. Lowell's branch of the family had lost its money, but really preserved its reputation, if we would like to put it that way. And then, as a student at Harvard, Lowell had been the genius of his class, as he was called, a man who had been picked out by many, many Bostonians as the guy to watch, the guy to bring on board, because he had so much talent.
I love the quote you have from him from his commencement day oration, 1854. He said, strangely foreshadowing the course of American history, "No nation, of course, can view its young men with indifference. The nurse of Krishna, from a Hindu religion, when she looked into the infant's mouth, beheld whole kingdoms. So each nation sees in its young men the means of fulfilling its wishes." Charles Russell Lowell, Commencement Day Oration, 1854. We have a lot of callers who want to join us. I want to begin to bring them in. Peter is calling from Boston. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. It's a great show, and I think a very relevant comment, discussion for tonight for Memorial Day.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know much about Mr. Colonel Lowell, but I clearly think the relevancy, he was of the mold of like Chamberlain and those Union generals and officers and servants, plus the Southern officers who became warriors. And I think it's absolutely relevant that, you know, these are the same, their forebears in this Revolutionary War, War of 1812, the Civil War, and the following wars, that you had people that stood up, and when they had to go to war, they were warriors.
And paint the relevance very plainly for us today as you see it, Peter.
The thing I see at this day and age is, unfortunately, the Lowells are not going to be in the Kerrys, and their children are not going to be in this Iraq war. And unfortunately, I see it's a kind of a working class dichotomy that's out there. I query, you go to Harvard, and I've been to Harvard, I'm a Boston native, and Harvard had their fair sons in World War One, Civil War, and World War Two.
Long lists.
You look at Iraq, and you can count, you can see how many Harvardians are in the military. And I think the unfortunate thing I draw on this is that what a disconnect now of those type of sterling characters that were willing to, maybe it was noblesse oblige, to say, hey, I step up to the plate because my country's at war. And there's such a disconnect now with that elitist and the, you know, upper class, and I think also middle, you know,
even middle, yeah,
who
yeah.
just don't want to make any sacrifice. And it's a shame. It's too bad that more history isn't taught to tell about these, you know, people like that who had so much going for them. And of course, you know, the way it sounds with him leading his charge, he was one of these, a warrior, and he was ready to lead his people and do what had to be done. And I just see it's a shame that we don't have that type of, you know, people across the country that are willing to make the sacrifice that, you know, we're at war, and nobody wants to step up to the plate except for working class kids.
And Peter, would you say this war deserves that same commitment?
I voted for Bush reluctantly, and unfortunately, I'm a Vietnam combat veteran of the Marine Corps. I couldn't vote for Kerry, and just because of past history with him. We're at war. Somebody's got to step up to the plate.
We hear it, and you put it forward with great clarity, Peter, and I thank you for your call. Carol Bundy, there's a lot of history we have to touch here, but you must be confronted with this again and again because your book comes out into the teeth of another American war where, exactly as Peter said, this class, the class that Charles Russell Lowell Jr. was part of, is really not represented. How do you look on that, or how might he look on this?
Well, you know, I think he felt that there were moral questions at stake and that there was a civil war. He felt that if the Union were to be reunified, there was a certain level of war that could not be fought. So he wanted to have men who were officers. He called them decent men. He said he had a muddled and twisted idea that somehow or other this fight was going to be one in which decent men ought to engage for the sake of humanity. And he was fearful that in putting our cause wholly in the hands of fighting men, he said, and foreign legions.
Foreign legions.
I know. But we didn't have foreign legions. Mm-hmm. But I think what he was trying to say was, you know, this is a war where people have a real stake, and the country's going to get patched together, back together after it. You've got to really think about the outcome while you're fighting the war.
There was also the definition of the goals of this war itself that he spoke to. Carol Bundy, author of The Nature of Sacrifice, a biography of Charles Russell Lowell Jr., is with us tonight. We're talking about a life and death in the American Civil War, who fought and who died in the Shenandoah Valley in 1864. You can join the conversation tonight. Can we draw a line from the sacrifices made in the Civil War to the sacrifices made today in Ramadi and Kandahar? And what's the trigger for a society to send its most fortunate off to war? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a life and death in the American Civil War, the story of Charles Russell Lowell Jr., who fought and died in the Shenandoah Valley in 1864, the Battle of Cedar Creek. My guest tonight is Carol Bundy. She's author of the new biography, The Nature of Sacrifice. You can join the conversation tonight. Can one soldier's motivations from the Civil War still speak to us today? And what is the trigger for a society to send its most fortunate off to war? The trigger for the sons of privilege to put on the uniform? Who is sacrificing today? Who's not? And why? And this, how does Charles Russell Lowell's story travel today across the Mason-Dixon line? What's the echo from the South? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Glenn is calling from Edenton, North Carolina. Hi, Glenn, you're on the air.
Good evening. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks, Glenn.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment that my ancestor also died October 19th, right there in Middleton. Basically, he was in the 12th Alabama Infantry, crossed the creek in the morning with his regiment, and they wheeled right, and basically he was blown to smithereens and buried in the mass grave in Winchester because it was just a big mass of body parts.
So he was part of that morning charge by the Confederates that first threw the Union forces into disarray, Glenn?
Correct. He went against the Sixth Corps, and according to the military records I have, he was disintegrated by cannon fire. So he must have been pretty close to the cannon before it discharged.
This war is like no other American war, of course, and that Americans were on both sides of it. When you hear the story of heroism on the northern side on that day, and I think anyone could see it, whether north or south, but how do you read it? And what about this issue of who steps up and who fights? Does it speak to you, Glenn?
Well, I think all of our country's wars have always fallen to the common man, and then, amazingly enough, these common people rise up and become incredible leaders, people that you would have never known about, like George Washington and Francis Marion and all these people during the Revolutionary War, and Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson, all these people that would just been very small footnotes in history. They were just ordinary people that rose to the occasion.
Well, of course, some of them ordinary, some of them common in the sense of men of no particular means. Others, like George Washington, men of enormous means. And
well, true, but I mean, it's a bisection of America. It's like a sample. If you took a core sample of America, you would get the elite, you would get the lowly, but they're all basically Americans.
And do you see that happening today, Glenn? And if not, does it matter?
Well, I see the common man rising up to the occasion and being incredible heroes in Iraq and Afghanistan. I personally feel we shouldn't be over there. I really do. I feel everybody over there has got weapons of mass destruction. No matter what we're going to do, people are going to get weapons of mass destruction. Somebody's going to use them eventually. We need to save our people for the future. We need to, you know, do what we can for our country here. We're not going to be able to save the world. We don't have the money. We don't have the people. I don't want to put down the common soldier because they are true heroes. I mean, they're fighting for our country. They're doing what the country is telling them to do. Mm. But I really feel we shouldn't be over in these other countries.
Glenn, I appreciate your call and appreciate your story from the other side of the Battle of Cedar Creek this evening. Thanks very much for calling in. Carol Bundy, you and Glenn, in a way, are bookends of this story. I mean, it's your great-great-great-uncle who died charging Middleton. It's his great-great-great, or along those lines, we have to assume, who died on the other side. How do you look out on the South? Because this was, for your uncle, a moral crusade, as it was a crusade for a different set of ideals in the South.
Right. Well, this is one of the great moments in researching the book, Tom, was going to Aldie in Virginia, where an important skirmish had taken place, and I was with one of the descendants of the major, Lowell's Fighting Majors, he was called, and I was there. And we walked the skirmish ground and ended up at a little church, and a man mowing the lawn stopped and wanted to know what we were doing. Mm. And he was the descendant of the man who'd owned the house where the skirmish had started. Mm. And so we were chatting to each other, remarking on this, that we were all there. And then another fellow with a metal detector showed up and wanted permission to comb the fields for whatever Civil War relics he could find. And it was just a wonderful moment in bringing the whole thing back to life and to feeling that, you know, this ground really did speak and people were still looking for its message. And, of course, there we were on both sides of the war, but chatting happily on a beautiful summer's day.
Descendants bound by that
bound by
memory.
Yes, exactly.
All the stories you describe, how you came across the materials from Charles Russell Lowell that kind of inspired you to do this. This is such an American story. I mean, I remember in my own childhood in the cellar there with my uncle, what great-great-great, Marcus, who fought and was wounded in Vicksburg. I mean, this does tie Americans from North and South together. But we can't look past the passion he brought to it. As you say, this kind of the cultivated images of martyrdom, thinking of sacrifice and martyrdom as a regenerative force with moral power. What was that? Was that all built around the abolitionist movement? Was it there some larger cultural context that exalted martyrdom in that way? Was it the Victorian romance with death?
Well, I'm not sure about the Victorian romance with death or when that actually began. A civil war
maybe
might
later
have helped it.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly that abolition as a Christian movement, which to a large degree it was, there were an awful lot of abolitionists who saw abolition as something that evolved out of their Christianity. And, you know, we don't need to look very far in Christianity for images of martyrdom and its regenerative force. So that's one aspect to it. I think another aspect was that, you know, civil war comes when everything else has failed. And the nation had been stalled in many ways because of this issue of slavery.
Its future could not be resolved. It's present even by that time.
Right. So the sense that this was this huge stumbling block that was getting in the way of all kinds of development was such that the need to push it away, to get it over with so that you could move on, I think was a very strong feeling, at least in the North. Obviously, the South felt quite differently about it, but I think in the North, that was a lot of the, let's say, the practical men.
The practical leaping into this kind of transcendent line of thought, the regenerative force with moral power of sacrifice, of martyrdom. Roger's calling from Pasquag, Rhode Island. Hi, Roger. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening, Tom.
Good evening.
Ms. Bundy. Mrs. Bundy, I'm looking at a picture of your great-great-uncle. He's a strikingly handsome young man.
Thank you very much.
All wars are fought for commodities. And I think sometimes you fight in the interest of the commodity, and sometimes you fight to steal the commodity. And I don't think I can put it any more clearly than that. The Battle of Cedar Creek, this is from Battles and Leaders. Battle of Cedar Creek has been immortalized by poets and historians, a transition from defeat, rout, and confusion to order and victory,
mm-hmm.
and all this depending on one man. Of course, that was Phil Sheridan. But just above that, among the killed in the final charge by the cavalry at Cedar Creek was Colonel Charles Russell Lowell. He had been wounded earlier in the day, but had declined to lead the field. And, Mrs. Bundy, your remark about his not wanting to go under the knife, oh, my word. And then in the next paragraph, the victory was a fitting sequel to Winchester, a glorious prelude to Five Forks and Appomattox.
So there we are. Roger, we've got the history. Tell us, when you say fighting for a commodity, what do you see that was in the Civil War? What do you see
it was chattel human beings.
All right, so fighting for liberation in that case. And the war in Iraq today, how do you define
It's a drug war. We're fighting for the world's narcotic, oil.
So does that mean men of decency, as Charles Russell Lowell had it, are required to step up today as well?
I think most people, we've been skirting around the old saying, rich man's war, poor man's fight. And I don't want to, you know, I feel very bad for these young people. I really do. When I was in Virginia last year, I stayed with a woman who had some history, and she said to me, you know, I don't mind if you excrete all over me. Just don't rub it in. And that was her feeling 100-some-odd years later.
Roger, we got it, and thanks very much for your call. So here's the death, and already Robert Gould Shaw had gone before him. He was celebrated, kind of a paragon, even before his death, in his society. Give us a flavor of how that society turned out, what they said, how they memorialized Charles Russell Lowell.
Well, I think that he was one of the first things that began to happen was that people named children after him.
That's pretty straightforward.
There were a lot of forts in the West named after him. There were poems written about him. Melville wrote a poem. His uncle, James Russell Lowell, wrote poems. He was part of the great commemoration, all the commemoration events at Harvard. Busts were made of him. His name was carved into stones. Soldiers Field in Boston, this great expanse of land along the Charles River, was dedicated in his name. I would say for up through the beginning of the 20th century, as long as his generation survived, he remained a kind of yardstick.
A yardstick of what? A symbol for what that went forward from that day at Cedar Creek?
Of commitment, of the cost of commitment. Even those men who lived into the beginning of the First World War, Henry Adams, Henry James, Henry Lee Higginson, Oliver Wendell Holmes, William James, these men would refer back to him in, you know, their last letters to each other. I'm trying to remember, it might have been Adams writing to Higginson saying, you know, he remains my yardstick of a kind of ultimate commitment, an ultimate standard of action. And I'm sure that for many of them, that was partly an expression of their own guilt at surviving.
At surviving the war, but it also brings us back to Lowell's own words, saying that the death of his wife's brother, Robert Gould Shaw, was part of a sacrifice we owed. Was that retrospective? Was that the sacrifice we owed for slavery?
It's such an interesting comment, because he normally was very disparaging of that kind of moralism, and he really hated something that happened in the North a lot, which was feeling that the war had some divine purpose, and that at least certain ministers thought they knew what it was. And his reaction was to say that he didn't think that it was man who could know God's will. And
much like Lincoln in that perspective.
Exactly. But clearly this is part of what the wounding of Shaw's death for him did put these thoughts into his mind. That, and when he says it was a sacrifice we owed, I think he's talking about the complicity of the North in the institution of slavery, which was huge. Not only was the textile industry in the North dependent on cotton, but Northern bankers held mortgages on Southern everything, and some of those mortgages included slaves.
And on that day at Cedar Creek, maybe he, in his own way, redeeming some of that.
That's likely.
Carol Bundy, it's a terrific story told with terrific, vivid detail. It really brings that whole era to life, and certainly brings your great, great, great uncle to life. We're very grateful to you for being with us tonight. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Carol Bundy, author of the new book, The Nature of Sacrifice. In a moment, America marks Memorial Day. This is On Point. Across the nations, Americans have marked Memorial Day with family get-togethers and barbecue, parades, and solemn ceremony. Several thousand, including President Bush and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, gathered at Arlington National Cemetery today to honor America's military dead. The president laid his wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns. He told those gathered that the troops who have died in Iraq have made America more secure. More than 1,600 U.S. soldiers have died in Iraq, including more than 70 this month alone. Here are some of the sounds of those marking Memorial Day today around the country.
Today we remember our troops in harm's way, just as we remember all those who selflessly defended our freedom in the past. All those who toiled, all those who sacrificed to build an abiding peace.
Since last Memorial Day, 832 fine Americans and 67 other coalition partners have kept their final rendezvous. They lie in the final formation.
We share with you our bewilderment, our grief of these lives that were cut short, all that might have been, that will never be, and yet we trust that in the great providence of God, that there is a grand perspective that we cannot yet understand. And we pray for all that there will be peace.
People realize what it's always young kids. You know, well, there's old people in there too, but it's the youngsters that get it, you know. And I think they should take more interest in it.
They don't even want us there. I mean, in all honesty, our boys are getting killed every time we turn around. More people get killed, and that's just military. Now it's civilians. And this is the so-called Iraqi people doing this. So, I mean, I feel for my boys. I give them the best. I hope them the best. Just come home.
Today, as we look out upon this garden of moving white headstones that honor the heroes of our heritage, we know his sacrifice was not in vain, nor have been the sacrifices of those we honor today in prayer and silently in our hearts.
General Eisenhower put it well in 1944 when he wrote his wife Mamie about the homes that must sacrifice their best. The families who come here have sacrificed someone precious and irreplaceable in their lives, and our nation will always honor them.
President Bush and other Americans marking Memorial Day in ceremonies today around the country. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.